Hello, and welcome to the Better Dental Life podcast, where we speak with extraordinary individuals who inspire us by showing us new possibilities and shattering our limiting beliefs. On this podcast, we don't just talk about better smiles, we talk about better lives. I'm your host, Mark Davis. It's time for another episode of the Better Dental Life podcast. I'm very excited for my guest today, Dr. Arun Garg. Now, I've known Dr. Garg for years because he trained me to place implants. He's the number one implant trainer in the U.S. and the founder of Implant Seminars, which is the number one implant training program. He's the owner of multiple practices, written many books. Dr. Garg, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, this is going to be fun.
Yes, absolutely. So whatever questions you got, fire away.
I will. First, I just want to say, because I have known you for years, you've been a great friend and a mentor to me. And I was just looking at the plaques that I had because we were moving our offices. So I was looking at the plaques from when we went to a Dominican, and I'm thinking, man, years we've been doing this together.
Yeah.
And you are the most influential person for me in my dental career. So that's why I'm so excited to have you on to talk.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. And there are others that are influential. I would say, you know, maybe another couple of individuals would be like Frank Spear, M.T. Osmanji have all influenced me.
Yes.
But as far as not only just placing implants, but introducing me to the coaching world and life, I love that. So that's what we get to talk about a little bit.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So I'm hoping first, maybe you just tell us your story. How did you become interested in dentistry?
I don't know. I mean, it wasn't unfortunately one of these routes when I hear from other folks that, well, I was 10 years old, I was 12 years old, I want to join the profession, or their dads were dentists, or, you know, a family member inspired them. It just sort of happened. You know, I went to undergrad. I really didn't know what I was going to do. And I was a chemical engineer, and I graduated as a chemical engineer. And my dad's a physician, so I'm aware of the medical side of things. And then a buddy of mine was applying to dental school, like my closest friend. So I didn't know what I want to do. Do I want to work as an engineer? Do I want to maybe apply to med school? Maybe go with my buddy to apply to dental school? I did a lot of things in student government as an undergrad. And a lot of those folks that were doing student government, I was just kind of doing for fun. They were doing it as kind of pre-law so they could pad their application for law school. And so a lot of my friends were doing is law. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll do that. And so I really didn't know. And I went with my friend and did very well in the DATs. And I'm a good test taker. Ended up applying to dental school, and I loved it. I went to University of Florida for my chemical engineering, went there for dental school. I came down to Miami, did a residency at Jackson Hospital, and I loved Jackson Hospital. I ended up staying there on the faculty for a lot of years, and then left kind of recently to go into private practice.
Now, did you grow up in Gainesville? Was that your backyard then?
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up in a college town and not many people grow up there. You know, the population of the town is only 30,000. The student population is 40 or 50,000. So the town is actually smaller than the student population.
Yeah.
And the 30,000 live there, of course, in some way or another are affiliated with the university. They're either folks like my dad, professors there, or the dads of most of my friends growing up were professors at the university. Or they may have a business where they sell bicycles to college students, or they have a business which is a restaurant that services the college students. You know, so everything there pretty much revolves around the college.
Now, was academics kind of important growing up? Were your parents strict? Did they make sure you had good grades?
You know, they didn't have to be. Is I grew up in a college town. I mean, it was not even a question. And so, you know, I hear kids talk about, well, are you going to college? You're not going to college, et cetera. It was just taken for granted. I mean, it was just like, you don't ask, are you going to go to ninth grade? You know, from eighth grade, you go to ninth grade. Ninth grade, you go to 10th grade. So for us, it was just 11th grade, 12th grade. It was just sort of expected you're going to go on for doctorate level something. So as I said, when I graduated, it was either get a job, maybe, but really go on for further education. So they didn't push me, and I didn't have to have a lot of self-motivation. It was just that type of environment. For me, it was a phenomenal place to grow up. Now it seems very small for what I do now, and I can never go back there and live. But it was a great place to grow up and great environment. And with all of that going on at the university, it was really a very creative space, because you can imagine a college town like that. lots of different ideas, lots of competing ideas. It wasn't where everybody's conservative or everybody's liberal, or everyone's this or everyone's that. So it really forces you to think and hear lots of different viewpoints. And I think a lot of those things are made me who I am. And since it's a small place, it was a small school. You know, I was in the same school from first grade to 12th grade. And we had 30 people in my class. And the 30 I started with in first grade, I think 20 of them I graduated with in 12th grade.
That's like the size of school clear out here in Lakeview. And people know I live out in the sticks. So I'm surprised that school is that tiny. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, everybody in my class, I knew for 12 years straight. It wasn't switching. It wasn't school buses. It wasn't any of that. A fun place for me to grow up.
So when you're finishing your residency as an oral surgeon, and then you decide to stay on
well, I did hospital at the dentistry, university. Yes. Yes.
Okay. So it's hospital dentistry. Yes. So describe that. Explain that to me.
Well, it was a GPR, a glorified GPR residency. It was at the hospital. So I finished that up and then they had a job opening there. And I said, hey, I'd like to stay on as a faculty member. And I was on the fast track. I had done undergrad early and I'd done dental school early. So I joined the faculty. I was actually the youngest faculty member in the history of the medical school. I mean, not just for that year, in the history of the medical school, the youngest faculty member ever. And because I'd grown up in academics, I kind of knew my way around in regards to the need for publications, the need for bringing in research grant funding. And so I did that. And I'd actually, with my father, had helped him with the English, the grammar part of applying for research grants and the grammar part of writing his scientific publications. So I'd been doing that throughout high school. So to me, editing and proofreading scientific papers and medical level papers, I'd been doing that since ninth grade. It came very natural. So I got a slew of publications. I was publishing a scientific article in one of the major scientific peer review journals about once a month. I was cranking out 12 articles a year.
So they must have loved you then.
Yeah. So, and most of the faculty was doing like one every 4 years. So I got promoted very quickly.
You became the implant guy there at the school. So how did that happen?
You know, Dr. Klein, who is the head of the department, the thing there, it's an oral surgery department and it's a medical school. There is no dental school there. And so there's no perio department, no prost department, no endo department, nothing like that. So within the med school, there's the normal departments you would expect, department of surgery, department of pediatrics, department of gynecology. And within the department of surgery were the different divisions of surgery, plastic surgery, trauma surgery, oral surgery, cardiothoracic surgery, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're simply one division in the department of surgery. And the oral surgery department at University of Miami / Jackson Hospital has typically been in the top three ranked in the country, some years one, some years two, some years three, but has always been one of the top. And, you know, when you talk about rankings in academics, it's not like a football team where they play against each other as a clear-cut winner.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, how do they rank, you know, which university, which is a department is good? It's based on things like the number of publications. It's based on things like the national recognition of the faculty. It's based on things like what the residents go on to achieve themselves, what quality residents is you graduate. For example, in the last 20 years, I think close to 26 of our residents have gone on to be chairmen of oral surgery departments around the country. And so kind of unheard of that we're creating guys who go on to become chairmen. Slews of books have been written by the faculty and our residents. I think in the last 20 years, probably 35 or 40 entire textbooks have been written by our faculty and our residents, our former residents. And so the caliber of folks that graduated is from there. So as he told me, you got to pick an area. He said, you know, we've got Marks here and he's an expert in oral cancer and bone grafting. We've got Joe McCain here, who's an expert in TMJ. Dr. Klein himself was an expert in facial trauma. Steve Holmes here, who's an expert in orthognathic surgery, and said, be a part of this department. You got to pick an area of expertise. And so there really wasn't a lot to choose from. I mean, kind of fortuitous for me. Dental implants, nobody was doing. And at that time, it was actually considered a little out there. I mean, there's a reason no one was doing it. Not quite quackery, but almost like that. So I chose it, or it chose me, because there weren't a lot of other choices. It was not the type of department where you just go and say, I'll have a cushy faculty job. You know, he said, you've got to become at nationally recognized level. Otherwise, you're not part of this team.
So then when you're nervous about like, oh, implants is all that's left, I'll try this for a little while and then maybe find something better.
Oh, no, he actually told me. He said, if you're going to do implants, because that's kind of out there, you better not give the department a bad reputation over this.
Pressure's on.
But yeah, it wasn't like a lot of warm fuzzies there. So yeah, and it just, you know, sometimes it is being at the right place at the right time. And implant just skyrocketed since then. I learned everything I could. I took all the courses. There weren't a lot of courses out there. And I had Jackson Hospital and I had lots, tons of patients. And so we'd implement things and try things and tweak things and invent things and retweak things. And every evening, all the faculty, all the residents, we'd sit around for hours at the end of our day and brainstorm with each other and kick around ideas with each other and critique each other's ideas and go back the next day and operate some more and tweak. And in that unique environment, it gave me the opportunity to invent a lot of procedures and perfect a lot of procedures and refine a lot of procedures and figure out what didn't work.
What was the community like with the other kind of implant pioneers? Because there are other guys, other places that are trying new things. Did you visit a lot? Did you talk and say, hey, I tried this?
Oh, absolutely. Great. Yeah. And especially early on, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie. I mean, in anything. And so there's a lot of camaraderie. I was much younger than those guys. And so it was not awkward, but very different. I mean, the other guys that were doing things when I was learning were 20, 30 years older than me. And so, you know, I was in my 20s. I did things on fast tracks. I was in my 20s and I wrote my first book. Textbook on donor implants is, I think, at the age of 26. I'd published 12 scientific articles by 26. And these other guys were 56. There was Carl Misch and there was, you know, a few other folks is out there. And there are some guys that were even predecessors to that, that were like Lanny Linkow and such, and they were, you know, 66.
So was it hard to get respect? Did you have to prove yourself in some way? Like, this young kid thinks he's everything.
Yeah, I think to some extent. And that was with the folks in the industry and then folks when I was giving courses. You can imagine is at the university, you know, after a while, I told Dr. Klein, I said, we got to start teaching folks this stuff because there's a lack of information out there. And I'd like to set up some CE courses. And he was great. He would let me do anything I wanted to, as long as it worked. Okay. I mean, that was the thing. you know, you weren't allowed to have failures, but as long as things worked. And so he gave me tremendous latitude. And knock wood, I learned early on that, you know what, if I get involved with a book or an article or a course, it worked because I had to. And so he gave me that latitude and we started doing these programs. And imagine, so not just my contemporaries, but imagine the doctors coming in the course. I mean, they're 45 and I'm 26.
Right. Yeah. Young guy.
Yeah. And they're like, well, I just paid all this money. Who is this guy coming in? So I learned early on that I wouldn't get to the lecture hall, you know, an hour early and mingle with people, that it was not good to mingle. Get more time under.
Does he know what question? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's my CE people, actually. There's a whole, you know, the medical school had an entire CE department. And they coached me on that. They said, don't come early. if the lecture's going to start officially at 8:30, but actually at 8:40, walk in at 8:40.
Don't shave for a few days. We'll lie about your age.
And a lot of times, you know, folks start out with like the basic fundamental and then build up the tougher and tougher cases. They said, you got to show a tough case right at the beginning. Then once you show that tough case at 8:40, as soon as you start, then of course you back down to start with basic court cases and building up. So, I mean, there were some things that had to be done, but it worked out great.
Now, Dr. Klein, you said gave you a lot of latitude, but you were trying new things. So, I mean, clearly sometimes things didn't work out. What did that look like? I mean, it wasn't something you'd publish or wasn't something you'd teach, but if something didn't work out at the clinic and in the hospital, how did that go?
Well, you know, things didn't work out. It might be a CE course, for example, and if it flops, it flops. But, you know, it was calculated. I mean, it would be things like we wouldn't rent a big hotel room and have a lot of expense or something. We'd do it at the university, free room. So if it flopped, it was some of my time, but it wasn't other things. And you go, well, if you ask him more about like a surgical procedure and you say you tried this and it flops, you know, I think I've always been very good about it. And all of us were in the department. The things that we push the envelope with and stretch the envelope with wasn't huge leaps at one time. It was incremental. What the public saw was a huge leap, but the way we did it was step by step by step. So, you know, so you may say, okay, let's take what we've been doing and the conventional wisdom has never been challenged. Let's modify it 2%. And if it doesn't work, we back off. but it wasn't a lot of harm done. If it works, let's modify it another 2%. If it doesn't work, we back off. If it does, you keep going. So very, very small incremental steps. So it wasn't where there's huge risks being taken. It's very, very minimal types of things. And then what happens is once you have refined something 50, 60%, then you publish it, then you present it. And it looks like, wow.
It looks like a big leap. Yeah.
What a game changer. Like, wow, you thought this one step. There was 100 small steps leading up to it.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because I've seen, you know, cases that make me go, wow, and you've been doing this for a long time, but cases that you and Dr. Mark's working together, growing bone in places that just seem incredible, but it wasn't like you just tried that right off the bat. You were playing with things for a while.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, Dr. Mark's now he regrows an entire half mandible, regrows an entire mandible.
Right.
If you look at one of his first bone grafts, it is smaller than a ridge split or a little bone graft you do now. And that was one of his first ones. And when that worked, he go, okay, let's make the next one a little bit bigger. And when that one worked, let's make this one a little bit bigger. And so it's very, very small things like that. So it wasn't like we are at risk or patients are at risk or anything like that.
I mean, there's its natural, I guess, union with Dr. Marks and you because of what he was doing with bone, what you wanted to do with bone, what you wanted to do with implants. And so you guys developed some incredible stuff, including, you know, working with autologous blood concentrates, or platelet-rich plasma, and all of those things. Just briefly tell me a little bit about where that came from, some of those ideas.
I think we're both motivated by growth, and I mean everyone's motivated by growth. But as you know, folks can be motivated by different things, like they want stability in their life or variety in their life or significance in their life. And for us, those things didn't matter so much. We just want to grow for growing sake. Learning new things is what kind of excited us and jazzed us. That was a huge commonality that we had. And we did it just for the sake of learning new things. And so we would treat patients. And I'm a clinician. I'm still a clinician to this day. And I love treating patients. I still see lots of patients. I think I'm at the stage now I could probably lock the doors and walk away from the clinic and be okay. I just don't see myself doing that because I love it so much. And, you know, before our talk here, I was in the clinic all day. And I think I shared that with you. I was there all day and I love what I can do for patients. I feel like I was given this gift, these hands to be able, and I want to share it with as many people as possible, as many patients, you know, these God-given gifts. I feel like almost like it's an obligation, but a fun obligation for me to share. So what would happen is since we operated so much and saw so many patients, it wasn't theoretical sitting by a desk or reading articles. You would see things like, wow, if I could do this and this, and then we could sit there in the evening and think of the theory on how to do X, Y, Z. So we would see the challenges because we did lots of clinical care. And I see a lot of university where they're not clinicians, it's hard for them to get the idea or the impetus to come up with solutions because they're not in there seeing the patients and they're not coming up with some of the things that maybe this could be tweaked better. I wonder if there's a solution for this. And when we do the high patient load and patient volume that we did then and now, it gives lots of opportunity to come up with what's the issue, what could we maybe do to minimize that or to just have solutions to it.
Yeah. And I think you guys were just hearing the stories because I've for years been hearing a little bit about your time at the university. And I suspect just from the outside that you guys just made each other better too. I think there's a little bit of that with you and Dr. Mark.
We had a lot of commonalities and a lot of similarities. And there was a lot of things that might have been each other's weakness and the other person's strength. And so that complement is there. And so that's why our first bone symposium was 1995 we held. And we asked 3i, Biomet, the implant company, to sponsor it because they knew about getting hotels and, you know, printing brochures and such. And that way it kind of limited the risk the university took. And we said, we're going to do 3 days just on bone. I mean, that would be like really for eggheads, not on implants. We kind of pitched the idea to them and they said, how many people do you think you'll get? And we said, well, maybe about 30 guys from around the country will come for such an esoteric topic. And they said, we bet you'll get 100. And we thought, no way, they don't have them in the country. And it turned out to be 300 folks that came. You know, the chairmen of most of the oral surgery and period departments in the country came. The program directors that trained the residents for most of the oral surgery and period departments in the country came. And it's huge. And I think single-handedly, either one of us might not have been able to pull that off. Parts of it that required my input and parts that required his input in order to really make it what it was. And so, yeah, we did complement each other and still do to this day.
After university, when you decided to take a leap by practice, start doing that. And then you started implant seminars right away as well, which for me seems just natural because you've been lecturing, you've been teaching. Yes. That's kind of what you've been doing. Did you know for a long time that that's what you wanted to do? Is it exceeded your expectation or is it about what you were kind of hoping for?
Yeah, I just kind of cut pasted what I was doing. I did a lot of patient volume. So I did that. I got a clinic in Miami, you know, built one from scratch exactly to my ideas. While I was at the university, we actually opened three separate clinics and sat with the university architects and the general contractors. And it wasn't something that I didn't enjoy. I kind of enjoyed that at the university. And they never paid us well, but they allowed us to buy whatever instruments we needed, whatever supplies we needed, whatever materials we needed, whatever books we wanted, whatever journals we wanted, and whatever kind of clinic we wanted to design. I mean, I didn't realize looking back on it now, it's like a blank checkbook. I mean, anything I would ask the architect for, he would draw it in and they'd built it for us. So I had the chance to build three separate offices there. And by the third one, it was like 98% exactly the way I wanted it. There's still 2% like, oh, I could have done that different. And so by the time I went into private practice, I had experience building three offices from scratch and sitting with architects and sitting with, you know, the Patterson Shine reps and measuring out the chairs and things. And so I was able to get it exactly the way I wanted. So cut and pasted the clinical portion, cut and pasted publications. I kept on doing them to a slower extent. I was doing about an article a month at the university and getting published in major journals, but I had a lot of residents with me. And so they could go to the library and pull the references. They could highlight the references. So I didn't have to read the entire article. Right. I would just read the highlighted portions. And then of course I'd add their names to the article. And usually I would put their names first. You know, I didn't need more publications. I would typically put my name last on it. But when I was in private practice, I didn't have that kind of support. I had dental assistants and I had hygienists. I didn't have doctor level residents.
Right.
So the article slowed down to maybe one a year instead of one a month. So cut and pasted that. And then the CE courses I was doing is at that time, kind of cut and pasted it and doing that. And then we grew those. You know, we grew that. We grew the clinical portion. And as you know, now it's multiple clinics. I grew the books portion. The article slowed down a bit, but the books grew that tremendously, grew the seminar portion. And that's just who I am. I just like growth for growth's sake. And so we grew all the things I was doing there. And then now that the university kind of handcuffs were off and shackles were off, I've grown a whole bunch of other things also. But yeah, it just kept on growing this. And at the level that we're at, you go, well, has it exceeded what I kind of thought when I was there? I was about the same. Right now, I'd say where we are today is about what I had envisioned. Now, I didn't envision beyond this. And if I continue like this and this type of a trajectory, then maybe if you ask me the same question, you know, 2 or 3 or 5 years down in the future,
you're going to say, yeah,
it will be like, no, I never would have guessed this.
It will. That's exactly what's going to happen. Yeah. People don't realize how, I mean, they think of you as the expert in implants and bone, but you're an expert in practice management and general dentistry. I mean, more than people I think expect, because you soak up knowledge, you study everything you can get your hands on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's phenomenal watching you with multiple practices and managing those. And then the rest of us can pick your brain and see how it goes. Let you experiment, figure things out for all of us.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it is modeling. And I was really fortunate with all the associations I got so early in my career. And really, it's University of Miami, Jackson Memorial Hospital, Dr. Klein, Dr. Marks. You know, with Marks, he's the guy that most of you would know that developed the hyperbaric oxygen protocols for radiated patients and for osteoradiated necrosis and almost the entire field of hyperbaric medicine. You know, there wasn't much hyperbaric medicine being done prior to him publishing on it. There was some. It was in the Navy for divers and such, but it wasn't in every hospital at that time. And a lot of that is really, it's almost like a medical specialty that was created on his work to a large extent. And of course, the guy who's protocol. So he's the expert in that, in hyperbarics. He's the expert in cancers, in oral cancers. You know, top selling book is from Quintessence, you know, the Medical Book of the Year Award. He does a course each year, you know, oral pathology review course. It's a 6-day course. It's from about 8 a.m. in the morning to about midnight every day. And every oral surgeon that's going to take the boards to get board certified ends up taking that course. And he's been given it now, like 35th year of giving it. And so he's an expert in oral pathology and then is at the same level in bone grafting and at the same level in growth factors between platelet-rich plasma and BMPs. So it's hard enough to become an expert in just one area. And he is an expert of the expert in multiple areas. So I had folks that I can model and say, Dr. Klein pushed, you got to become an expert in a area. And then I look at Marx is like, okay, maybe pushing to become expert right. in multiple areas. So it's modeling the people around me and just kind of, it wasn't even by design. It just kind of happens when you see it. And I think what happens is when you see people doing the things, it is much easier to eliminate the limiting beliefs that all of us have, because all of us yeah. eliminate beliefs like, I can't do this. I won't be able to do this. I won't be able to do that. And when you see people around you that you see every day over lunch and dinner and shoot the breeze with at the end of the day, and they are doing all the things that you're limiting, right. it blows the limiting beliefs out of the window.
Yeah. And you do that with your students with every time you teach. That's a lot of your program is say, look, other people can do this. Yes. And you make a point to show cases from students. This isn't just my cases.
Right.
But there are other people like
just
you.
Like you.
Yeah. Just like you. They can do this also. Day. Right. Yeah. And that works because it's those kind of things that we suddenly go, oh, I guess I could try that. That could work out. Yeah. And it's incredible how that works because we all, like you said, we all have these limiting beliefs in procedures. We have them with our income, with how much we think we can do in the clinic, in the office, and our hourly. And I've had those blown for me many times.
Yeah. You know, the story of Roger Bannister, people thought that the human body is incapable of breaking the 4-minute mile. And for thousands of years, nobody had broken the 4-minute mile. Nobody had run 1 mile in 4 minutes or less. And Roger Bannister was the first one to break the 4-minute mile and proved that it could be done. The year following, once Roger Bannister did it, over 30 people broke the 4-minute mile. So what he did is he showed it could be done. He took the limiting beliefs out. And now you have folks in high school breaking that.
Right.
Something that for thousands of years seemed undoable. That the human body was incapable of. And once it was shown that it is possible, you have so many folks doing it. So a lot of times that's all it takes is showing folks that it can be done. And then even better would be showing how it can be done.
Yeah. Well, and like, you know, we talked about, you've been doing that with implants. And I want to talk just for a minute about the Titanium Partners. Mm-hmm. Can a mastermind group for dentists is ultimately what you put together. I've been a member. I've loved doing it. And I think this is really unique and revolutionary in the dental space. I mean, there are mastermind groups on the coaching side. I see those. You see them in business. But in the dental space, I think it's pretty unique. So I want to get your thoughts first, and then maybe I'll tell you some of my thoughts on it, having been a member for a couple of years. So what motivated you to start Titanium Partners?
You know, I'd always wanted to, because in essence, what you and I have been talking about for these last few minutes is my own mastermind group. We didn't call it that. But as I said, we would work and see patients all day. We'd finish patients, and we didn't finish at 5:01 p.m. We'd finish usually at 7 or 8 or 9 o'clock at night. Then we'd sit around, we'd grab some dinner, we'd grab drinks or something, or we'd just grab some sodas and sit around and talk about our cases from the day. And that would be the faculty and that the residents and all of us, similar intellectual passion, similar intellectual level, and sharing ideas and critiquing each other's ideas, as I said. And that's something so missing in what is in essence a cottage industry in dentistry. Because when we finish at the end of the day in a dental office, when I finish in one of my clinics at the end of the day, even if the folks wanted to stay there, wonderful people I work with, but they may not have the same intellectual passion if they're dental assistant or dental hygienist or a front desk person, or they might. They may or may not have the same level of training or the same intellectual abilities. And so that's who I've left a mastermind with in essence then. And so I always wanted to be able to do for others kind of what had been done for me my whole career. And even when I'm not at the university, I've kind of had the ability to do that, because since I give my seminars essentially every weekend, yes, I'm lecturing during the day, but I do receptions, as you know, because you've been there.
Right.
I do receptions in the evenings. And what am I doing? I'm mingling with mastermind group in essence, right? Unofficially. So I get that creative stimulus and those ideas, and I give them, and we're all sharing them. And I was doing that at the university in the evenings. I'm doing that at my seminars now. But I realized for most folks, they don't have that ability. They might, you know, add a CE course once every few months or so, and it might be an hour in the evening. It may not be. So could we do a format where we do dedicated weekends to masterminding, not just maybe a evening for them? And so maybe 2 weekends, maybe 3 weekends, maybe 4 weekends a year. And doesn't take time out of the practice. Is maybe a Saturday and Sunday. And the entire weekend is dedicated to masterminding. And folks can, as you get 20, 30, 40 people in the room, someone says what their choke point is, you know, what's holding them back from getting the next level. We got 30 opinions in the room, not from other, but folks that at your level. And so that's what's so exciting about it. And if there isn't an answer right away, you got 30 other mastermind guys helping to look for the answer over the upcoming next few months. And the next time we get together, one of them can say, oh, you know that thing you'd said last month? I heard this and this from others. I think there's a solution for that to get you to the next level in whatever it is that you want to get to the next level in.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's exactly that. And I think that naturally, just by people wanting to be part of that type of group, yeah, it is automatically grabbing the upper echelon of dentists. So it's, you know, the lower, the bottom, you know, 50%, the bottom 80% even, they're not interested. And so you're getting the top dentists. And, you know, we all know that we are the average of the people we hang out with. I mean, that's been said many times. If you hang out with five people that are overweight, you'll be the sixth. If you hang out with five millionaires, you're going to be the sixth. And so you want to hang out with a lot of dentists that are successful in many different ways, in many different styles of practice. That's what it's meant for me, but not just in dentistry, but also you've managed to bring in some coaching into that success in life, which is what I'm passionate about, and actually really sparked that passion for me to start coaching and go to life coach school and make that a bigger part of my life was really coming out of there. Some of the people we've been able to contact with. So I think it's been phenomenal. I've loved it. I don't know your numbers. And so I hope that you do very well with implant seminars, but I do know the numbers from Titanium Partners. This is not a big moneymaker for you. And so it's,
no, it's not.
This is your opportunity to give back, kind of contribute, I think, in a lot of ways, which I know you value. So how do you balance that?
No, it's not a money generator. It's a passion project, you know, but I have a lot of passion projects. And I think it's important for folks to do passion projects. People call them things like hobbies, right? Someone likes to work on a car, or someone likes to, you know, is go golfing. I mean, those might be passions. And here's a passion project that actually helps me grow on top of it. Because yes, we're all sharing ideas. I'm sharing ideas. I'm getting ideas. I'm implementing ideas. I come back from a mastermind group and, you know, I'm in the clinic the next week and I'm going over with my staff the things that I want to improve in the clinic or modify in the clinic. And so, yeah, there may not be a monetary reward per se as far as that mastermind group, but the indirect, I think there is a monetary benefit in terms of helps growth of my practice. It's personally very satisfying. You know, it's a great, great group and everyone is very collegial and there is some selection process that goes on. It is a bit of that too. And then that's part of it. I mean, in life is it can't just be about working. It can't be just about hobbies like golfing or tennis or whatever it may be. But they can be things like this, which is really, really creative time. And we can have fun like with a hobby and yet grow like we would in the profession and grow maybe even more, grow faster with really, really cool ideas.
Yeah, it's been fun. And, you know, we get to do this a couple times next month for a couple of events. So
absolutely, yes,
we get to hang out some more. And I do enjoy our time spending together more than, I mean, I purposely want to rub shoulders with people that are very ambitious and successful. And you're the hardest working person professionally that I know personally. I mean, I know there are others out there that put in a lot.
When folks say hardest working dentist that I know.
Right. It's like, oh, everybody's working 3 days a week. And yeah, exactly. But you put in some hours and you put in a lot of weekends. And I love that because that's what I like to be. But I, you know, so there's part of that wanting to hang out is certainly that, hanging out with successful people. But you're also just, it's fun to be around. You and the other guys in the group are just fun to be with. So it's a nice time. So what are you most excited about in dentistry right now? Anything that you're thinking is pretty exciting?
Oh, I'm always excited. And, you know, I told you I was from when, you know, implants was almost like considered quackery. And here it is so mainstream and the most lucrative part of dentistry and one of the most exciting parts of dentistry. But, you know, there's so many new things. I'm working hard on learning more and more of digital things. You know, I'm working hard on 3D printing. It's not because I want to save the lab cost and make my own mouth guards or something. I mean, it's not for that. But I think there's some other applications to it that would be fun. I don't know, and I don't know enough about things like sleep apnea and such, but that's kind of exciting area. The folks that are treating that really seem to be very excited about it. I think I'd like to learn more about that. So I'm excited about that. The kinds of treatment plans that are accepted by patients, you know, a 10, 20, 30, 40, $50,000 treatment plan can be presented without you or me, the dentist, choking on the words and being accepted by patients. Not often, but yes. Whereas 10 years ago, the dentist would have choked at numbers like that. Patients would have choked, and other dentists would have laughed at those numbers. And so, wow, what a cool place that we're at in dentistry that we can say those kind of numbers with confidence and get them accepted. You know, is what dentistry is doing is so different. Dental economics, they used to say that the practice that grosses $1 million a year, that was in the top 1% of practices. There was an article. I mean, I remember that article. I wish I still had it. And today there's so many practices that produce $1 million a year and way beyond that. So dentistry has completely changed and it continues to. And then you hear numbers of whether it's good or bad, but these things, the resale value of practices, either to individual owners or, you know, big DSOs and such, but the resale value of practices, you know, that was never a big retirement plan for most doctors because you could just work 8 months longer and get the same practice, you know?
Right.
And now you can get so much for it. And so there's so many new things and fun things as valuation of practices, the kind of treatment plans that can be done, the kind of revenue that practices generate, cool things like sleep apnea, cool things with digital. And then I think marketing is changing a lot in dentistry. So I just like to learn and grow. So that's kind of, it can be looked at as a negative that, oh, wow, I got to do new marketing techniques. For me, it's kind of fun and jazzes me that get to do new marketing techniques.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. So if people want to get a hold of you, they want to take a course, they want to do something with you, what should they do?
How
do
That's easy. I don't need to give a big infomercial, but you know, if it's implants, just implantseminars.com. But in addition to implants, now we do 28 different courses on different topics, oral sedation, soft tissue, all on X, zygoma implants, dermal fillers, there's Botox, there's a lot of different courses. I don't teach all of them. I teach the ones that are in my wheelhouse and that I enjoy. And I bring in the best in the country for the others. Or my direct cell number is 305-331-6481. That's my direct cell number. And yeah, I personally take the calls.
That's pretty brave of you. No, I love that. You actually are always been very approachable.
Yeah, I give my phone number to all my patients and I've always given my number to patients. It was from the university days. I went to private practice. I always gave it. There might be one patient a year that abuses it or something.
Right. Most and people are too timid to give you a straight up call.
Exactly. And I've always given my phone number to all the folks in my courses. I'm giving it now. I think for too long in medicine, it was considered like, whoa, I don't know.
Yeah, don't do that. Yeah.
You had to jump through hoops. And communication is a good thing. And I don't believe in creating friction to get communication. I believe in decreasing friction in order to maximize communication.
Yeah, I love that. I appreciate that. Well, we are going to have you on many times because I mostly wanted to get a little bit of history and lay some groundwork because, you know, in some episodes coming up, we'll talk a lot more about practice management. Maybe some more about implants and how that can work in people's practices. So I appreciate you coming on. I've loved this. It's been a lot of fun. And we'll catch you next time.
Thank you. Good night.
This episode of the Better Dental Life podcast was brought to you by Better Dental Life. When you are ready to transform your life, transform your practice, and expand your income, become a member of Better Dental Life. You can find out more about us at betterdentallife.com. Make sure to search for the Better Dental Life podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and click subscribe so you never miss an episode. On behalf of the team here at Better Dental Life, thank you for listening.